Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 250, Transformative Education with Aftab Omer. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
The litmus test for authenticity is the teacher and the student, both at the same time being in the unknown together. And the transactions between teacher and student, typically in informative learning, are not that way. The teacher knows, the student doesn't know. In transformative learning, the authentic moment and when the process is most authentic is when both teacher and student don't know and are in a don't know space.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Aftab Omer, discussing transformative education. Aftab Omer received his bachelor's from MIT and his doctorate from Brandeis University. He's president of Meridian University in Petaluma, California, which infuses transformative education and innovation into its graduate programs in psychology, business, education, and the arts. Aftab's research has focused on the emergence of human capacities within transformative learning communities, and his work includes assisting organizations in tapping the creative potentials of conflict, diversity, and complexity. His publications include The Spacious Center, Leadership and the Creative Transformation of Culture, and Between Columbine and the Twin Towers, Fundamentalist Culture as a Failure of Imagination. He's fellow of the International Futures Forum and the World Academy of Art and Science. Now, here's the interview. Aftab Omer, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be participating in this series.
Well, I just want to set the stage a little bit for our listeners. We're sitting in a kind of anteroom here that is part of both your home and some piece of the campus and offices for Meridian University. Is that right? I remember attending a workshop here once.
Yes, this is Meridian University's downtown center, where we have mostly offices, and then our campus is about 20 minutes away.
Yeah, and very beautiful. We've got a new collaboration with a group up in the hills of Petaluma. So we're in Petaluma. It's a very colorful a little California burg not far from where I live, one of my favorite places to hang out. And it's a beautiful sunny day, and sunshine is pouring in through the windows that are very plenteous in this room. So let's get into it. You and I have been colleagues and friends now for quite a few years. We won't say exactly how many. And you taught for a number of years in the psychology department at Sonoma State University. And then you went out and started your own graduate school. So how long has that been now?
Well, David, you and I have known each other actually for 25 years.
Oh, my goodness. I had no idea.
And I remember various conversations you and I have had about psychology. And I particularly remember a conversation about Rollo May's work and our mutual admiration of Rollo May's work.
Really?
This was a conference on humanistic psychology in Santa Rosa. And I very much appreciate what you have done, what you have put together. This library of podcasts is a phenomenal collection in terms of psychology and its broader applications, what you have collected here.
Well, I thank you for that. And of course, I agree. How could I do otherwise? So how long has it been since you started this graduate institute?
Meridian just began its 18th academic year.
Wow. Well, it seems like just yesterday that
you just, you know, I remember you striking out and you're going to start your own place, which seemed a little outrageous at the time. But boy, you've certainly made a go of it. Now, one of the things I was interested in when you sent me, I asked for some background information for the show notes, and I see that you got your bachelor's degree from MIT, which I'm very impressed by, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Does that mean you have some technical proclivities in your background? Were you perhaps planning to be an engineer?
Well, in high school, I went to a science high school.
Uh-huh.
And it was not a very thoughtful choice. I did well in junior high in science and math, and so it was the next thing to do is go to a science high school, which was a high-powered high school. And then from there, the trajectory gets set. But what really worked for me at MIT is the degree to which science per se, social science and humanities were in dialogue. Mm-hmm. MIT was a very rich place for that kind of interdisciplinary dialogue.
Did you have a major? What did you end up getting your degree in?
I had an interdisciplinary major.
Ah, see, that fits you as I know you.
And so that was just right. And we could take courses at the other great universities in the Boston area. Harvard was literally 3 miles away.
Yeah.
And so it was a very rich kind of curriculum that we were able to put together, those of us who were in this interdisciplinary program, and it was just referred to as a interdisciplinary program in science and humanities. But it let you ask very broad questions, and it let you not become specialized too early.
Okay. And was psychology in that mix at all?
Psychology was very much in the mix. I don't know if you probably remember Hans Teuber.
I can't say that I do.
He wrote one of the early texts, but now that we are here we are in the age of neuroscience, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Just where we are, if we think about 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago, and my undergraduate years are over 35 years ago, the neuroscience was not around the corner, but psychology at MIT was very involved with physiological psychology. That was pretty much what was taking place.
Okay.
And then at Harvard, up Massachusetts Avenue, there was psychophysiology, including Gary Schwartz and Dan Goleman. And so it was very much a part of it, physiological psychology, psychophysiology. But at the same time, there was somebody like Noam Chomsky very much looking at what psychology's impact was on the larger society.
Okay, so you went on from there to Brandeis to earn a PhD. I feel so provincial trying to pin you down to, well, what was it in? But what was it in? What did you get your PhD in?
I asked Noam Chomsky, what is the next step given what I'm interested in?
Uh-huh.
And he recommended going to Brandeis, specifically to Brandeis's sociology department, not psychology department.
Okay.
Maslow had already died, and the Brandeis psychology department was moving rapidly away from the kinds of things Abraham Maslow and what has come to be known since then as transpersonal psychology were doing. But literally across the yard was Brandeis University's sociology department. And that was truly an interdisciplinary place. It was called sociology, but it was a place, again, it was an interdisciplinary inquiry was what took place there.
Okay, well,
so
let's move.
So culture, psychology, politics,
yeah,
social change, all came together.
Yeah, and that's how I know you, as being very Catholic in your interests, very broad interests, and very integrative. I recently got some feedback from one of my listeners that I dwell too much on people's backgrounds. And so I better get into the meat here of our interview. I know that part of what drove you to found your own graduate school was your passion for transformative education. So I need to ask you, what do you mean by transformative education?
Transformative education needs to be contrasted with transformative learning.
Okay.
Transformative learning is the larger process that takes place within spiritual traditions, increasingly in workplaces, which are also learning organizations, and also higher education. And so typically, we're using the phrase transformative education to refer to transformative learning in the context of higher education. But there is an underlying process and practice that's ancient, and that's what we have in mind when we say transformative.
Okay, so it raises the question of transformation from what to what?
Good, good. It's we're constantly asking the question, what transforms in transformative learning? And there's a number of ways to speak about it. Identity transforms, consciousness transforms, experience transforms, behavior transforms. And when we're speaking of transformative learning in the context of organizations and communities, then we can also say culture transforms.
Okay, well, I'm still interested in this issue of transformation and how much of it rests with the educator and how much with the learner.
That's a question asked by an educator.
Okay, yes. It's certainly something I've struggled with.
Yes.
So tell me about how you wrestled with it.
Well, I mean, since we both taught in the psychology department at Sonoma State, and you still do some.
We know
the challenges, and it works, of course, best when there is a authentic collaboration between the student and the teacher. Because unlike informative learning, which can be very content-centered, the teacher decides what is the content, what's the range of information that has to be transmitted, and the student essentially complies in absorbing and assimilating that information.
Right, and you use the word authentic or an authentic collaboration. It seems to me that's really key to what you're talking about. Maybe say a little bit more about the role of authenticity here.
Well, the litmus test for authenticity is the teacher and the student both at the same time being in the unknown together. And the transactions between teacher and student, typically in informative learning, are not that way. The teacher knows, the student doesn't know. In transformative learning, the authentic moment and when the process is most authentic is when both teacher and student don't know and are in a don't know space.
Now, that can be a little scary, I think. To be scary as a teacher, to be in a don't know space if I'm supposed to be like the expert, and scary for the student maybe too.
That's true. That's true. There's definitely a fear evoking dimension to transformative learning. I often say that transformative learning is perilous because of the unknowns. And I like to point out that true experience, authentic experience, is intrinsically perilous. And it's recognized by the etymology of the word experience, that the P-E-R-I in the middle of the word experience is the same root as in peril.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So the language is recognizing the perilous nature of experience. And transformative learning takes place by creating context for new and unfamiliar experience.
Seems that there might be some parallels between psychotherapy and the kind of learning that you're talking about. Say, you're nodding your head.
Very much so. Very much so. Psychotherapy could be understood as a special case or type of transformative learning. Construing transformative learning as the larger, more ancient process that human beings have been involved in.
And more ancient than anything that we would call psychotherapy.
Absolutely. Yeah. That psychotherapy, we're talking about 130 years.
Right.
So very much a outcome of late modernity and the catastrophic cataclysms of late modernity.
Mm-hmm. Part of what I was thinking about in bringing that up was that we were talking about fear, and that made me think about resistance. And we talk about resistance in psychotherapy, and there must be a similar dynamic in transformative learning.
Absolutely. Resistance and working intelligently and collaboratively and authentically with resistance, and back to the teacher-student collaboration. That's at the heart of the transformative learning process. If no resistance is evoked, it's not transformative learning. Because in transformative learning, the learner is going from one way of structuring their understanding to another way of structuring their understanding. And this shift from structure to structure has to evoke resistance, because if there is no resistance, that means no structure is being pulled at.
Yeah, and so it's threatening. And one of the things I've reflected on is, you know, parents send their kids off to college. Seems like all parents want their children to get an education, but at the same time, it's perilous for parents because their kids are going to change as a result, and they don't necessarily want them to change.
True, true.
We've both been there.
Painfully true.
Yeah, we've both been there. Okay, so I'm still interested in this place of fear, of authenticity. And also, I know something that you've alluded to in some of your writing is mystery. Where does the mystery come in?
So, John Keats wrote a letter to his brother that is referred to by often. And in that letter, he uses the term negative capability. The importance of a person having negative capability, which is to say, be present in an unknown, uncertain place and be able to inquire and not have to know. So this taste for mystery goes deep in us human beings. And we can see this in the history of religion, the unfolding of spiritual traditions.
I'm sorry, did you say the taste for or the distaste
the
for?
The taste for mystery, okay. Yes. It's even been referred to as our one taste, ultimately being a taste for mystery. And so we see that, of course, in literature. We see that in the primary form of contemporary ritual that we have right now, namely film.
I think I need to interrupt you there, because that's a very interesting thing that you just said, that film as ritual. I've never thought of film as ritual. How is film ritual?
Well, film provides us with transformative experience. However, transformative experience doesn't equal transformation. We have transformative experiences far more often than we might remember. And we are transported in a good movie. Mm-hmm. We go there looking for that. We typically don't want to know how the movie ends. Some people don't want to know anything about the movie.
That's me. I don't want to read the review until I've seen the movie.
Same here. So that taste for mystery that goes so deep in who we are as humans is part of what we go to looking for in film. And it's part of what ritual in its most authentic sense provides. I don't mean ritualism, which is ritual that has gone dead, mm-hmm. where it's about repetition and it's about the security of repetition, of doing the same thing, rather than authentic ritual, which carries one into mystery. And so the best films do that. I mean, one of my favorite films, perhaps my most favorite film, is Lord of the Rings.
Okay, yeah.
And a movie of that depth for sure evokes transformative experiences for people. However, a number of other things have to take place for the transformative experience to in fact have the outcome of transformation. And that's what transformative learning is looking for, is to provide transformative experiences, but do that with sufficient degree of transformative practices, as well as a transformative learning community, so that those transformative experiences can have enough traction so that the individual or the community or organization can go from one structure through the middle zone, the transition zone, the liminal zone, as Victor Turner would call it, over to the other structure.
Okay, now you've brought in the notion of community here, and I gather that's an important component of what you do. So just say a little bit more about community and its role in education and transformative education, because I know in many cases people are going to school, they're going to university, but they might be commuters, they might feel very little connection or sense of community.
Learning in community shifts our whole individualistic understanding of learning. We take exams individually. We, of course, the degree is awarded to an individual. And all of that makes sense because we're going to be accountable for whether learning is happening or not. That needs to happen. But deep learning is very much a social process. And so creating a context for learning and referring to that as learning community has become more and more recognized in higher education. And even in high school, my son goes to Petaluma High School and they have learning communities there. So, however, a transformative learning community takes learning communities to a whole other octave because the requirements of what the learning community needs to be able to functionally pull off are significantly more. Because now the learning community has to be the container for the liminal experience, for the zone of transition, where one is structureless. The old has dropped or is dropping, and the new has not formed. And in that limbo, we need a container. And it turns out that a container of other learners is optimal, of course, with sufficient guidance. And so there is a definitive role for teaching in this.
Okay, yes. I was going back to therapy, and in therapy, particularly Jungian therapy, they talk about the container, having the safe container. And so it's an interesting parallel here that it's more the community. It'd be more like group therapy, that it's the community that's the container, but with the role of the educator being key to sort of setting the tone and making sure that the boundaries are not violated. So far, our conversation has been pretty abstract. I wonder if you can make it more concrete. You have a university program here that's based on this kind of learning. Maybe there's a class that you or somebody else has taught here that would exemplify some of the processes that you're talking about. Anything come to mind?
In transformative learning, we must work with identity often first.
Okay.
Because identity is how we maintain a particular way of perceiving something. So when we want to take a fresh look at a topic, let's say grief, in our psychology program,
okay,
we may have students speak about grief not as themselves, but as if they were their mother or their father, for example. And just that very simple role play, we could call it, opens the space for thoughts and statements which would not be said by the person if they were speaking just as themselves. Another example would be having a conversation not in the present time, but as if we were having a conversation 3 years from now. So, David, you and I might pretend that we're having a conversation 3 years from now, and we're talking about what transformative learning in the workplace looks like now in 2013. And even these kinds of spaces, these kind of shifts, rather, in identity, in time and space, open new perceptions. And when we have new perceptions, being able to see something new, that's a transformative experience. Now, whether that transformative experience can then keep going and become an enduring way to perceive differently requires much follow-up.
Yeah, now the first example that you gave of speaking of my grief as my mother, not my grief, but my mother's grief, but it, putting myself in her role, I could imagine that that might bring up some deep feelings, even though I'm, quotes, not talking about myself. I could imagine that might be tearful. So I'm wondering, what is the role of emotion and feeling in this approach?
One of the real values of transformative learning is how transformative learning can bring together cognitive learning and emotional learning. And in fact, we could even add somatic learning. So the cognitive, somatic, and emotional dimensions of our experience can all be brought together in transformative learning. And the way that happens is through focusing on imagination. Because as you know, all the neuroscience that has so intensely taken place in the last 10 years has not shown a single location for where imagination lives in the human nervous system. Because imagination is this emergent property of the human nervous system. And its role is, it has this integrative function. So by focusing on various kinds of imagery, not just visual imagery, we're able to bring together the cognitive and the somatic with the emotional.
Oh, that's fascinating. I know that initially this educational institution that you've created here had a different name for a number of years. It was the Institute of Imaginal Studies. And so I guess the reason for that was rooted in what you've just said.
Well, until about a year and a half ago, we were offering psychology programs. And these psychology programs, which we still do, the psychology programs were centered in a focus on imagination, because with that focus, we could gather the ways in which different orientations to psychology have primary concerns that may have to do with feelings, the way humanistic psychology has had, or with consciousness, the way transpersonal psychology has had, or somatic psychology with its focus on the body, that by being imagination-centered, we can bring all, we can gather all those dimensions of human experience.
Okay, that's reminding me that I had a rather broad question for you relating to psychology, and it may be way too broad for you to speak to, but I'll give you a chance to take a crack at it. What's your personal take on the current state of psychology and where it needs to go? Is that too broad, or can you grab hold of a piece of that?
Well, as you well know, and I imagine suffer, that mainstream psychology is still largely cognitive behavioral, with the emphasis on evidence-based approaches.
Right.
And as we both know, that working just with cognition is far too limiting in terms of transformation, that that there's the rest of us, and the rest of us resists in all kinds of ways. You know, resistance shows up emotionally. Resistance shows up somatically, like feeling tired or sleepy in certain kinds of learning situations. So,
or daydreaming.
Absolutely.
I did a lot of daydreaming in school.
So this focus on cognition leaves too much of who we are as human beings. And so it's important that psychology take a more integrative approach to human experience. And that's happening. That is reflected, for instance, when we look at the APA program, when the annual meetings of the APA, one sees that broadening in the program itself.
Yes, I was surprised because I didn't go to APA for years, pretty much having the feeling that it was them, that other camp, and that there would be nothing there for me. And I was surprised when I finally did go a few years back to find that, hey, there was the field really has shifted, I think, in some important ways, and people are more open to an integrative kind of an approach. And lots of people in the behavioral camp were certainly not in the extreme behavioral position that I would have projected.
There's great research happening in psychology and, of course, in neuroscience in particular.
I agree, and it feeds the series, really.
Yes.
You know, all the interesting things that are going on.
Yes, and you're finding some of the best neuroscience research and putting it into podcasts, which is really valuable.
It's been really exciting to me, as I've observed on the podcast several times. You know, you made reference to physiological psychology that you took way back when, and I did too. And at the time that I took it, we were learning the names of all these structures in the brain, but nobody really knew what they did. And now we're just learning so much about what these structures do. Just, I think it was just yesterday that I interviewed Joseph Ledoux, who was on the Charlie Rose show when they were talking about the brain. And he's one of these people who kind of studied the amygdala in particular and studied the role of fear and anxiety in the amygdala. And he also addressed self. And what his conclusion is, at least at the time that he wrote his most recent book, is that self is distributed. There is no self-center, and that kind of relates to what you just said about imagination, that there's no imagination center. Rather, it's a distributed process that's kind of greater than the sum of its parts. You know, before we run out of time, there's another big topic that I wanted to undertake with you, because I know that you were interviewed for an article titled Between Columbine and the Twin Towers, and the subtitle of that was Fundamentalist Culture is a Failure of Imagination. Hey, that relates to imagination. Mm-hmm. So I'm really concerned about fundamentalism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what was your thesis around that topic?
Well, one way to understand fundamentalism of any type, whether a particular religion or a particular a view about how psychology should be done, yeah, or anything should be done. Most generally, fundamentalism is having a unreflected, not being able to reflect upon one's own beliefs, taking one's beliefs entirely. I remember walking through Detroit Airport once and seeing a woman wearing a T-shirt, and the T-shirt said, "I have my story and I'm sticking to it." Mm-hmm. So, fundamentalism is, I have my story, and it's the only true story, and it's not even a story, it's the way things are.
Right.
And will always be.
Right.
So, when we conceptualize fundamentalism in that way, then we can see that every fundamentalism has a loss of imagination in it. Because when we are in imagination, we're able to move from perspective to perspective. That's what imagination lets us do. Mm-hmm. Is see familiar things in new ways and be able to see things that we were never able to see. Whether it's about nature, whether it's about people, and particularly different kinds of people. And so this propensity to fundamentalism that seems to be part of the human inheritance has enormous consequences when it comes to intergroup conflict.
Right.
And it becomes, you might say, the cognitive and emotional basis for enemy making.
Right now, it seems like we're at a particularly perilous place globally. We have, you know, obviously a major block of fundamentalism in what we call the Middle East. And then we have our own fundamentalists here in the U.S. and in the West. And do you see any, is there any hope? What is the path? How does one reason with people of the fundamentalist persuasion, since they seem to be so close to this, mm-hmm. Putting themselves in the other person's shoes? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. This is a, there's a real role for transformative learning here. You might recall the Camp David agreement that Jimmy Carter helped to bring about.
Yes.
And here we are decades later and the Middle East is still in agony.
Yes.
But there was Jimmy Carter, Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin made significant progress. And the way it happened was by going to Camp David and being there for a few days.
Dialoguing
mm-hmm. and this suspension of being at Camp David. Mm-hmm. And since then, Jimmy Carter has spoken in interesting ways about how they were able to make that progress, what kind of conversation it took, what kind of suspension of positions it took. And we know this from other kinds of work in negotiation theory and negotiation practice, how important it is to create a liminal context, a time and space which is neither here, neither part of the old nor part of the new, but it's in the middle. And in the middle where people can have the experience of suspending their beliefs, suspending their positions, which amounts to looking at one's beliefs rather than looking and speaking about what we're in conflict about through the lens of those beliefs. So, one way to imagine it is being literally taking off one's glasses and looking at the glasses and speaking about the glasses, the lenses, rather than what one was looking at through the glasses.
I guess it takes a really skillful facilitator to help create that container to draw people into it. I seem to recall that Carl Rogers was doing very similar work towards the end of his life. I'm not deeply knowledgeable about that, or do you know?
Very much so. The Carl Rogers, based in the Center for the Studies of the Person,
yeah,
and with colleagues like Maureen O'Hara, were precisely working on this idea and did very large events internationally, Europe, Brazil, focused on and taking a week together, sometimes 2 weeks together, because it does take a significant amount of liminal time so that the suspension, the necessary suspension, can take place. Because if we are fundamentalist in a particular area of our lives, that means we identify with those beliefs. It's part of our identity. And what that means is it takes transformative learning to emerge from some area of our life where we are fundamentalist. Even addictions can be partly understood in this way. We could say that where we are fundamentalist, we are addicted to certain beliefs because our experience is that we are those beliefs, that we wouldn't be here without those beliefs. And transformative learning contexts like the ones Carl Rogers and his colleagues were providing were short-term, but short-term could mean as long as a week or two, but short-term contexts where people could be in this in-between place. It could be betwixt and between.
Yeah.
So as to arrive at the end, arrive at a new place and see new vistas.
Yes, it's interesting how we've come full circle. I mean, how the transformative learning actually turns out to be a key to resolving this fundamentalist issue. And I know anecdotal accounts from, you know, Carl Rogers working in Northern Ireland, working with between blacks and whites, working in some other kinds of conflicted areas. So on a small scale, we've seen it work, and we know that it can work. It's dealing with this much larger scale. And, of course, you gave the example of Jimmy Carter, who was able to get leadership involved. I think there are lots of examples where, at a grassroots level, it's been possible. Palestinian and Jews have met, and I've seen films of things like that with beautiful results. But it's the larger scale, I guess, where the challenges still remain. Well, I'm thinking that we're kind of running out of time here. There's so much more that we could talk about, but we probably should begin to wrap it up. I wonder if there are any final thoughts that you'd like to leave our listeners with.
Desmond Tutu wrote a book with the title No Future Without Forgiveness. Mm-hmm. We could also say No Future Without Transformative Learning.
Okay, well, Dr. Aftab Omer, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. Thank you for doing the series, and thank you for inviting me.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with my friend and colleague, Dr. Aftab Omer. First of all, let me say that I hope the recording was of acceptable quality. As you heard, this was an in-person interview, and I decided to see how good a job my iPhone would do using Griffin's iTalk Recorder Premium. Because I wasn't using lavalier microphones, but just set the iPhone on a table between us, there's a little bit of an echoey room ambience. I think I'm going to be exploring the use of external microphones with the iPhone once I figure out a way to do that. I was particularly interested in Aftab's comments on the importance of authenticity in transformative education. The bulk of my own educational experience as a student was definitely in the transmission of information modality. I sometimes can't help envying today's students who are able to find non-traditional programs such as Aftab's at Meridian. The most transformative experiences for me happened while in my doctoral program at the University of Michigan, and they were less a result of faculty involvement and more the result of peers who created an encounter group movement in the department. At that time, there was a lot of ferment going on at the two ends of the country. There were T groups coming out of the National Training Laboratory in Bethel, Maine, and encounter groups coming out of the Esalen Growth Center in Big Sur, California. My grad student peers and some junior faculty were pollinated by their experiences with these two organizations, and they brought them back to Michigan. So there was this explosion of interest in group process and honest, open, authentic communication. And my experience in encounter groups during that period put more of a stamp on my own approach to teaching than any other influence. Also, on the theme of authenticity, toward the end of my grad student days at Michigan, I was desperate to start my doctoral research project and to get out. I made a number of false starts. I finally found a faculty person who was willing to take me under her wing to do an extension of her research, if I recall correctly, on the fantasy lives of menstruating women. So I went around seeking additional members for my doctoral committee so that I could get started with that research. I approached one of those junior faculty who was at the center of the group dynamics movement, and he refused to be on my committee. I was shocked because I had looked on him both as a bit of a friend and a personal champion. So I asked him why he wouldn't be on my committee, and he said it was because it was clear to him that the project I was proposing didn't reflect my own authentic interests, and he would not support me in being inauthentic. Well, I was kind of outraged and disappointed. You know, I protested, but I do want to get out of here. I practically wailed, and I'd been attempting to get a research project off the ground for about 3 years, but he stood his ground, and as a result, I ended up doing my research on a topic of genuine interest to me, on the role of attention in hypnosis and meditation. So after 3 years of false starts, I completed it in 3 months from start to finish, powered in large part, I guess, because it was an authentic interest. Now, I've always remembered and been grateful for that challenge to be authentic, and I can only guess how I might have turned out had that been a more consistent theme throughout my education. I've tried to embody that lesson in my own career as a teacher. I think Aftab embraces these ideals even more so, though. So if you're interested in learning more about transformative education and or Meridian University, I'd invite you to go to their site at www.meridianuniversity.edu.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. Shrink wrap radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back, all you regulars, and a big welcome to any first-timers out there. I'm so glad to have you all here. It's a gray and rainy Sunday afternoon here in Northern California as I record this. You might even be able to hear the rain pinging in my gutters just outside the window. Are you a procrastinator? By the time you hear this, or at least by November 1st, 2010, there will be a new interview on my other series at wisecounselpodcast.com, and it will be with Dr. Monica Ramirez Bosco, an internationally recognized expert in cognitive behavioral therapy, and we'll be discussing procrastination. So fight your tendencies to procrastinate and take a listen to that one. Once again, I want to remind Australian listeners about the Psychoanalytic Conference with Dr. Jonathan Shedler. The conference is open to all and will be on Saturday, November 13th, 2010 in Sydney, Australia. That's not so far away now. I've put the PDF of the conference flyer with full registration details on our site, and you'll find it under the promos tab at shrinkwrapradio.com. Hey, we have a new transcript on the site, and it's one that I've been trying to have someone do for a long time. So I want to give a big thanks to Trina Fink for her transcription of number 222 with my good friend Dr. Ron Alexander on his new book, which continues to do quite well. The title of the book is Wise Mind, Open Mind. You recall that Ron is one of my former students who's made very good, done very well, and the fellow who I've had the privilege of assisting with some of his groups in the U.S. and Europe. As I scanned the transcript, it brought back the interview to me, and it reminded me of Ron's clarity and wisdom. Speaking of old friends, I had a wonderful Skype conversation with my friend Jerry Trumbull earlier today, and he regaled me with a host of wonderful stories of goings-on in and around Denver politics, which he's been covering both as a videographer and a blogger. I wish I had pressed the record button, but it all would have been pretty off-topic for this show. But he's such a wonderful storyteller that I would have liked to have captured it. At any rate, it's definitely time for Jerry and me to have another conversation for Shrink Wrap Radio. So we're hoping to put that together real soon. If you're new to the series, you might want to look back in the archives for some of the Dave and Jerry episodes. And speaking of the archives, don't forget that we also have a store tab on our site where you can purchase 3 archival CDs covering the first 75 episodes of the show. Each of the 3 CDs is just $9.95 plus shipping. In addition, if you need CE units, we have 2 APA-accredited courses where you can earn your units by listening to selected podcasts from Shrink Wrap Radio. One course is on the wisdom of the dream, and the other is on positive psychology and the quest for happiness. And while you're on our site, you'll also find links to discounts at Angie's List, 4inkjets.com, and ShoeBuy.com. Now, in fact, I just took advantage of my own discount code of shrinkwrap at 4inkjets.com to buy a whole boatload of inkjet cartridges for my Epson printer. Well, boatload is an exaggeration, but you know how frustrating it can be when you're trying to print out something important, maybe to meet a deadline, as I was, and suddenly your printer is just spitting out blank pages or text laced with white lines running through it? So I jumped right online at 4inkjets.com and ordered a special package for my Epson model. And I think I got 14 cartridges for as a little bit over $65. And that's around $5 a cartridge. And in this economy, it's too good a deal to pass up. So using the discount codes on the site is certainly a way of supporting the show, as well as savings for you. And I also want to thank those of you who've clicked on that big green donate button on our homepage. And your one-time and ongoing donations help keep my enthusiasm up in this 6th year of Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, this is Patrick Thornton, Santa Rosa, California, a therapist, and I have been on the couch with Dr. Dave. And it's been a pleasant couch to be on.
Thank you, Dr. Patrick Thornton, who will be my guest on our next episode. Now let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. First, we hear from Nicole, who made a PayPal donation to the show and who writes, I subscribe because I've been listening to your podcast for a couple of months and have sent them on to a few colleagues and also even to some clients who I thought would be very interested in particular topics. I've already had my money's worth, so thank you. I also like the Australian All in the Mind podcast that you've also mentioned. I live and work in Sydney, so this is a brilliant way of listening to some of the great thinkers and therapists that you have on your continent, although I appreciate that you also go beyond the Americas. Makes the world feel a whole lot smaller. Warm regards, Nicole. Well, Nicole, thank you for your donation and for taking time to write. And inasmuch as you are in Sydney, I hope you'll attend the psychoanalytic conference there that I've been talking about here on the show. You'll find the flyer about it under the promos tab at shrinkwrapradio.com. And in part, the next one from Tanya in British Columbia reads, Dr. Dave, I just wanted to write and tell you how much I appreciate your Shrink Wrap Radio podcast. I stumbled upon them about a month ago and have been enjoying them immensely. I feel I've found a very wise teacher. I have learned so much about myself and the human condition through you and your guests. Your interviewing style is insightful, thought-provoking, and very accessible. Thank you for taking the time to make these inspiring interviews. Thank you again, And that's from Tanya in Victoria, British Columbia, Canada. So Tanya, thanks for your kind words. Tanya went on to recommend a possible guest who I will look into, but I won't read that part of her email just now. And here's one last one for today. Hi, Dr. Dave. I should probably comment on your site to save you time reading this email, but I'm a bit shy of doing that. I just wanted to thank you for the fantastic podcast with Rick Hansen. I found this podcast fascinating, and with all the information he shared, it sounded like there could be many more podcasts with Rick. I listened to the podcast on Shrink Wrap Radio and the Wise Counsel podcast, although I'm still working through the archives. I've also listened to other podcasts in various fields whilst painting, for example, podcasts on technology, art, etc. And without sounding like I'm picking on other hosts, I wanted to say that your skill as a host is above and beyond that of others I've listened to, and the audio quality and professionalism of your podcasts is fantastic. I haven't consciously compared your podcast to others. I don't want to come across as mean to other hosts. It's just something I noticed whilst listening and wanting to pass on to you, as you are very generous in the work you do for your listeners. Best wishes, Orla. Thank you so much for those remarks, Orla. Certainly, I enjoyed talking to Rick Hansen quite a bit, and we got some comments in the comments area on the site, and I found him easy to talk to, and I would love to do future interviews with him. And your use of whilst makes me think that perhaps you're in the UK, maybe. I don't know for sure. But I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You just click on the title of the show, and that takes you to the longer view with the comments area below. No need to be shy about that. And, of course, you can leave voicemails on Skype, where the name is ShrinkPod, or you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Dr. Aftab Omer for sharing his insights on transformative education. And as I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Dr. Patrick Thornton, and we'll be discussing the use of mindfulness in psychotherapy. Dr. Thornton, a local psychotherapist and Buddhist teacher, was ordained by Thich Nhat Hanh and studied mindfulness-based stress reduction with Jon Kabat-Zinn. It should be an interesting interview. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.